Is it time for a mind shift? If you don't know what that means, then join your host, Dr. Clint Haycock, a former evangelical Christian pastor and Bible college teacher of over 20 years, along the journey of deconstruction and reconstruction of faith, life, religion, and spirituality.
Hey everyone, welcome to this special bonus edition of Mindshift Podcast featuring returning guest Catherine Stewart. I know we had some other stuff planned in the pipeline, but this was an opportunity that came up. It was just too good to pass up. What happened was the other day over here in the UK, I saw on Channel 4 News, there was an interview with Rob Reiner, who of course is the director of The Princess Bride and many other movies. And he was talking about his new movie, God and Country, and I was absolutely fascinated. In fact, I recorded the interview and watched it later with my girlfriend and said, you've got to see this. But looking at their website, godandcountrythemovie.com, it says, quote, Christian nationalism is the belief that America should be defined as a Christian nation with government adherence to this ideology. God and Country takes a closer look at the dangerous implications and explores how a base of Christians had radically stoked a movement, erasing the line between church and state, end quote. And of course, if you've been following this podcast at all, you know that this is exactly what I've been talking about for years now. And I had the chance to reach out to Catherine Stewart because I saw her name as one of the producers. And as she will describe, she has a role in the film, quite a large role. More or less, her book, The Power Worshippers, is the basis for this movie. It's kind of the scaffolding or the basic undergirding of the whole movie. And then what was sort of providing talking points, I came across a really good article on the Right Wing Watch website by Kyle Mantilla, and he's a colleague of my good friend Peter Montgomery, who I've had on the show many times. And he basically went through, because a lot of the stuff from the movie are clips from the Right Wing Watch YouTube channel of these extremist Christian nationalists, dominionist so-called prophets, and so forth. And so Kyle went through and detailed sort of in depth each sort of figure from the movie and has little clips on that. So I've got a link to that article in the show notes as well. So if you want to do a little bit more research and reading, in fact, I'm going to reach out to Kyle. Peter Montgomery actually gave me his email address. I'm going to try to reach out to him. Apparently, he doesn't really like to do interviews, but I would love to chat with him as a colleague of Peter's working for People for the American Way. I think there's a Right Wing Watch. So let's get on into this episode. We're going to have, as I mentioned, the last one. The next actual episode that comes up is going to be with Ren Story and then Jonathan Davis. And don't forget, we have got our Mindshift Podcast Zoom call with returning guest Sarah Hayward on the 24th of March. And these are available for Patreon supporters of the show. So you can link to that in the show notes, how to be a Patreon supporter. That gets you access to our closed Mindshift Podcast Facebook group, as well as these monthly Mindshift Zoom calls. We had one last month with Joshua Stewart. It was really, really good. And that is available on Patreon to watch as well. So anyway, without further ado, here is the conversation between myself and Catherine talking about this new Rob Reiner documentary or film, God and Country. I'm so glad to welcome back returning guest Catherine Stewart. Been on the podcast a number of times before, so welcome, Catherine, back to Mindshift Podcast.
It's great to be back. Thanks so much for having me.
Yes, I'm so excited to talk to you. I know we only have a short amount of time, but we've got this new movie that's just come out. I don't think it's made it over here to the UK yet, but it's called God and Country, and it's playing in selected theaters in the United States, I believe, directed by Rob Reiner. But you are a big part of this movie, from what I understand. Can you tell us a little bit about how you came to be involved in the movie?
Sure. In 2021, the Reiners, through Warner Brothers, optioned the rights to The Power Worshippers, and the Reiners serve as producers, not directors. Rob Reiner and his wife, Michelle Reiner, are producers, and the film is directed by Dan Partland, who also directed a film about Trump called Unfit.
Yeah, I noticed that because I found a really helpful article on the Right Wing Watch, and I think the Right Wing Watch played a big part in the movie because, according to this article, February 15, 2024, by Kyle Mantilla, who's who in God and Country, he says that they use a ton of clips from the Right Wing Watch as far as like, you know, who's who in Christian nationalism. So, you know, thank you to the Right Wing Watch. I've got a good friend, Peter Montgomery, that's I've done a lot of stuff with. So what was the connection between the Right Wing Watch and the movie as well?
Well, I can talk about the connection between Right Wing Watch and my book and articles. And I've included many links too in the footnotes and also in some of the pieces that I've written for the New York Times and New Republic and elsewhere. Many of the, you know, there are a lot of links to audio and video captured by Right Wing Watch. They're just such an important organization. And Peter Montgomery is really spectacular and has been following this movement for many, many years. Mm-hmm. So I owe a lot to them.
Yes. Like I said, Peter's a really good friend of mine. I've had him on the show, I don't know how many times, but he's one of the best resources as far as you're talking about Christian nationalism, dominion theology, and all that stuff, which of course ties right into everything you talk about in The Power Worshippers, as well as I would say your other book, which is The Good News Club, and how the Christian right's been taking stealth sort of approach to public schooling.
Right. The religious right has long sought to weaken public schools and destroy the institution of public education as we know it, and also to divert taxpayer money to religious schools and religious organizations. So they've actually, that book was published in 2012, and the war on public ed has continued apace. It's intensified in many regards. The sort of fake CRT stuff that they've been promoting, it's really a way to soften the ground for a wholesale assault on public schools by undermining public confidence in public schools. We know that they don't teach CRT in public schools. CRT was taught previously in a handful of, I think, law schools or graduate schools here and there, but it was not ever taught in public schools. But Christopher Rufo, who is the architect of the anti-CRT hysteria, said, we need to, essentially, I'm paraphrasing here, he said, we need to de-link the word CRT or the term CRT from what it really stands for and get it to people to think that it applies to a whole range of things that they simply don't like. And and then, that's exactly what they did. And so these sort of hysteria, this book banning, all of the, fake CRT stuff, all of that is intended to reduce faith in public schools, to soften the ground for defunding public schools and funneling that money to private religious organizations.
You're absolutely right. Anytime I hear somebody use the phrase government school, referring to public schools, my antenna just goes right up, because I know that is a phrase, I don't know if he coined it, but it's one of the sort of keynote phrases of R.J. Rushdoony way back in the, even going back to the 50s and 60s. I mean, if we go right back to some of the beginnings of the Christian right, that was long sort of baked into the DNA, wasn't it? In fact, this article, I sent it to you this morning, I think might make some good talking points, this one by Kyle Mantilla on the Right Wing Watch, because what if we go right back to the beginning? He names three characters that appear in the movie, one of which is Jerry Falwell, then you've got Pat Robertson, and then you've got Ralph Reed. These guys are instrumental in sort of getting the early Christian right off the ground. What can you tell us about these three men?
Well, I think, we need to preface all of this by saying that Trump is a symptom of Christian nationalism, right? Not a cause. The movement preceded him by more, decades or, even longer. I think you can draw the roots. There's always been a strain of very reactionary sort of authoritarian thought and theocratic thought in the United States. I think we can go back even to the pro-slavery theologians, people like Robert Louis Dabney and James Henley Thornwell. And please bear with me for a minute, because Thornwell, so if you read some of what he wrote, these are theologians from the Southern Presbyterian Church who called slavery and hierarchies, not just of white people over black people, also men over women, ordained by God. They called this was to them God's established order. And they looked at liberal theologians who are trying to promote abolition as heretics, as atheists. And they said as much. They said, Thornwell said, this is a battle between the forces of regulated order on one side and atheism, you know, heretic thought on the other. Godlessness on the other. And their ideas were drawn upon by Rousseau's Jean Rochedenis, who was a mid-century godfather of Christian Reconstructionism, who had this very strong, you know, very anti-democratic idea about how our government should be run. And his ideas were in turn drawn upon by a lot of the religious right leaders today. Now, someone like Ralph Reed, I would see more as a political operator.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can never know what's in people's hearts. It's hard to know, you know, what he believes and what he doesn't. But he has, for a long time, been a very clever religious right strategist and activist. Every year, he runs his organization as Faith and Freedom, called Faith and Freedom, and then he runs a large conference of activists and strategists and allied politicians called the Road to Majority Conference. I've been going to these Road to Majority conferences for many years. I don't attend every year, but I go from time to time. I do see some of our friends at Right Wing Watch some of the time.
As they still let you in.
Well, listen, you just sign up and pay your ticket and you can go like everybody else. And that's where you see a lot of the strategy. I mean, Trump knows he would not have won in 2016 without this movement's support. So he has really given to them everything they wanted and more, you know, policies that privilege their religion over others, the kinds of justices, not just in the Supreme Courts, but also in lower courts that they want, because a large component of the movement is about legal strategy and legal activism. They know if you can form the courts, you can get the culture. He's given them unprecedented access, political access and power. And they, in turn, have really kind of stood behind him. The movement and its, you know, very densely networked infrastructure, parts of it function as a giant voter turnout machine. And in election cycles, they deliver, you know, I would say the most reliable slice of the Republican vote. Mm-hmm. So any candidate on the Republican side who wants to win really needs to curry favor with them.
It's true, because speaking of the Right Wing Watch, our good friends over there, if people have not found their Right Wing Watch YouTube channel, that you need to, because I was having a look just the other day, and they showed a clip from Donald Trump speaking at CPAC just a couple of days ago as we're doing this recording now. And what you said is exactly what Trump said to these, it was the Christian broadcasters. That's what it was. And he was saying to these Christian broadcasters, hey, listen, you're going to have unprecedented power if I get reelected. You had a lot of power when I was president before, but that was nothing. That pales in comparison to what you're going to have if you will vote for me in 2024. So yeah, he's not even saying the quiet part out loud, is he?
No, I mean, the amazing thing at the Christian broadcasters, a national religious broadcasters convention, cast this as a war on Christianity. And that is absurd, because a lot of American Christians are Democrats. But he's saying, you know, they what he's doing is a typical authoritarian identity politics, really. They divide the world between us and them, right and wrong. He also said something that he said in other settings, which is the greatest threat we face is not the enemy, our foreign enemies, the greatest threat is the enemy within. Now, authoritarian or fascist leaders use this kind of divisive rhetoric to divide people, to make the country more chaotic, more polarized, less governable. And that clears the way for an authoritarian leader to step in, or a fascist leader to step in and say, I alone can fix it. Mm-hmm. So
I am the chosen one.
Divisiveness by design.
Yeah, that goes right back to Conway and Siegelman, doesn't it? Holy terror. What did they were tracking this back in the late 1970s, early 1980s, how these fear tactics and terror tactics were being used by the early Christian right. One of the things I've been going through recently, I've been reading through Francis Fitzgerald's book, The Evangelicals, The Struggle to Shape America. I mean, it's a huge book. But one of the things she said the other day, I'm through the part where she talks about Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson. And she said, the thing about Jerry Falwell was he was the epoxy that glued the early Christian right to the Republican Party. And she said the other half of the equation was Ronald Reagan. So that goes right back. I mean, he was one of the first ones that really got that vote out, like you said, wasn't he? Urging Christians to vote for certain candidates and against other candidates. So Falwell and Robertson, I mean, they were huge in the nascent Christian right, weren't they?
That's absolutely true. You know, Falwell embodied a whole lot of contradictions. He was often described as a very warm-hearted guy. And, you know, he seemed to, people sort of thought he was very kind, had a very easy manner. He was often celebrated as having a big heart. But he regularly spewed this really contemptuous language toward others, right? People who of whom he disapproved. He blamed the abortionists, the feminists, the gays, the lesbians for the September 11th attacks. And I remember when Francis Fitzgerald profiled him for The New Yorker in 1981. It's a really terrific profile.
Yes, I read that article.
He said, separation involves hard, grueling controversy. It involves attacks, personal attacks, even violent attacks. And then he said, aggression is an expression of brotherly love. So it's really kind of shocking. It sort of reminds me of a lot of the times that I've interviewed people for this movement. Often they actually seem very kind in person. They seem to love families. They seem to, you know, genuinely care about their communities. But all of their good intentions are being harnessed in service of this agenda that is dividing Americans, polarizing our country as never before, and is really threatening to destroy the norms and institutions of our democracy.
It's so right. You know, because I remember when I was a kid, I was 13 years old in 1979, the year that the Moral Majority was founded. And I can remember being in church. I was a fervent evangelical back in those days, growing up in the Seattle, Washington area. And I can remember our pastor, his sermons were just infused with Christian nationalism. And all that stuff was coming out of things like the Moral Majority. He's talking about, you know, America's on its way downhill. These liberals are taking over. Roe versus Wade had just been passed a few years before. Abortion, homosexuality, the ERA, the women's rights, you know, all these kind of things. America is, you know, we got to clean up America. That was Falwell's words. And that kind of stuff resonated in churches nationwide, didn't it? Telling us who to vote for, giving out voters' guides, you know, so these guys have had a massive impact even since, 1979, 1980, going right back.
That's true. I mean, I think we have to think about this movement, not just in terms of religion, but also in terms of information bubbles, because in some ways, what's really distinctive about this kind of polarizing religion is it functions as a way of containing information and, you know, limiting the information that people have access to and propagandizing them. And it also functions as a way of cultivating fear. They're coming for you. They're going to take all your money. They're going to change your gender against your will. And they're going to steal from you all that you hold dear. And making people afraid makes them manipulable, and especially when they don't have access to the facts. And so I think that it includes, when you look at sort of the Christian nationalist movement overall and the sort of magnification of the movement, you know, the infusion of Trump, we can see that there are all these elements that are really not religious at all. I'm thinking of the QAnon stuff, right? So there's a continuum and they have a lot of features in common, the sort of QAnon world and religious nationalism. They're not quite the same. But so I think sometimes by calling it a religion, we're missing the defining aspect of it, which is illiberalism and irrationalism.
And anti-democratic, isn't it? Because let's go now fast forward. We've talked about Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, you know, Ralph Reed, guys like that, Tim LaHaye. These were instrumental in starting the Christian right. Now you get a guy like Greg Locke. There's a list that hits a rogues gallery, but he puts it together. Kyle Mantilla, okay, he's an election denier. He's never accepted, you know, Biden winning the 2020 election. He's a mega conspiracy theorist. And this is what he does, you know. And now you got a guy like Greg Locke, and he's hanging around spouting all this stuff, and it's kind of all come together, hasn't it?
It really has. I think that the involvement of pastors like Greg Locke and the fact that they have such vast platforms should obliterate any illusions that this is a conservative movement. This isn't a radical movement. They're blowing through the guardrails of our democracy.
Yeah.
They're providing a kind of permission structure for political violence, and it's very dangerous.
It is. And then you get, I mean, again, going through this article, it's just a rogues gallery. You go from Greg Locke, then you got a guy like Charlie Kirk. You've got Rick Wiles, Lance Wallnau.
I have a funny story about Rick Wiles. Can I tell you the funny
story? Yeah. He's another one, man.
I was in Costa Rica. This is maybe 10 years ago. I was doing a different story, not related to religious nationalism. I was taking a break. And so I'm like doing a story about, you know, just something completely different. I'm like, I need a break. Look, I've been writing about the religious right for 15 years. So I go to this town in Costa Rica, and all of a sudden I'm meeting all of these people who said that they are Rick Wiles fans, and he has told them to move to this one place in Costa Rica where they're building some town because the end times are near or there's going to be some problem. This is during the Obama presidency. And
the apocalypse
and a lot
is
of
coming.
People were like, right, this is awful. the devil is in charge of America, whatever, all of the racist stuff. So you had all these people who are Rick Wiles or True News fans who had moved to this place in Costa Rica, and I met with a couple people who are sort of trying to work with them and get them settled, or, you know, and it was just astonishing. You know, a lot of them didn't speak Spanish. You know, my feeling is
if
you should learn your please and your thank you, learn excuse me, learn may I have a cup of coffee.
Donde es baño, amigo? That's one of the phrases I've always, you know, where's the bathroom? Where's the toilet? And dos cervezas, you know, if you order a beer and go to the toilet, you can get by in Spain or wherever.
It was funny, but it's also really kind of sad, you know, that all these people were so disinformed and so propagandized. And, you know, look, again, you know, I go to Reawaken America tours. I talk to a lot of the folks. A lot of them are not, you know, wouldn't say they're bad people. You know, love their families. So they think they care about their communities. They think they're really doing what they need to do to save America. Because, look, this is a leadership-driven movement. And the leader cadre is very different from the rank and file. And it's the leaders and the sort of network that's promoting all this disinformation aimed at those folks. And what's the sad thing is, it's like they're, you know, just, you know, fomenting identity politics. But the movement leaders, they're not just promoting, you know, a couple of culture wars. It's not just about abortion, same-sex marriage. They're bringing in a kind of tied to a kind of far-right economic ideology that is intensifying economic inequality, which is a real problem in our country. You know, we have a real, you know, we're in a new gilded age and life is getting a lot harder for, you know, most working families. Mm-hmm. And they're eroding rights for the workforce, they're even going after child labor protections, and they're so a lot of these folks are being persuaded to sort of vote or act in ways that are actually not going to help them.
Yeah, I think it's true. This whole thing, and like you mentioned that word, a continuum. What strikes me going through Fitzgerald's book, she does a fantastic job of showing how these sort of things were connected. Because you got a guy like Lance Wallnau, you've got someone like Kenneth Copeland, Jim Baker. These guys go right with Jesse Duplantis, who's another one. But these guys have been around for decades, and they were connected to Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson. You know, Jim Baker, obviously, he got his start on the 700 Club, him and Tammy Faye Baker, didn't they? So then they split out and did PTL and all the rest of it. So these people have formed that continuum. They've taken that message to a whole nother level. And it's that stream of disinformation. They're watching Fox News. They're watching OAN. They're watching True News. They're watching, this is where they're getting their quote unquote news from, isn't it?
It is. I mean, it's interesting. I think for a long time, people just thought of the religious right as, you know, a bunch of people who want a seat at the table and the noisy form of American democracy. They, you know, just want to have a voice. They just, you know, want some, you know, care about some culture war issues. But there are folks like Peter Montgomery and just so many others. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've been following this movement for a long time, too.
Yeah.
When people would, you know, been longtime observers of the movement would raise the issue of theocracy or dominionism.
Yeah.
So many commentators, you know, dismissed them as hysterics. And now that Christian nationalism has openly allied itself with an effort to overturn an election and is backing an authoritarian and deeply corrupt candidate, I think the facts can no longer be denied.
It's true. I mean, this is the thing. I was talking to Matthew Taylor. We had a podcast not long ago, and he was saying, I asked him at the very end, what are you concerned about going into the 2024 election? And he said, well, there's basically three different outcomes. Either Trump wins, which is a horror show, or Biden wins and Trump refuses to accept the outcome of that election, or it's such a close race that it goes to like recounts and recounts and drags on and on, at which point Trump's supporters could rise up with, you know, violence. So what's your take on it? What's your concern going into the 2024 election?
Well, I echo all of that. Mm-hmm. I think that we can't really face our challenges until we know what they are, and continuously, you know, framing this as a culture war, as many mainstream commentators do, suggests it's really just about a few social issues that are sort of at the margins of life. But they don't really get that this is about the overall distribution of power and freedom in our society. I mean, look, take the struggle over abortion rights. Mm-hmm. It never was just about a single medical procedure or X number of weeks of restrictions. It's really about the role of women in a society. It's about the role of religion in society. And it's about democratic freedoms. The whole point of banning abortion or making, you know, doing these sort of ridiculous, you know, life begins at the moment of conception, therefore we have to ban IVF stuff. Mm-hmm. It's to humiliate women in such a public way that it shows the power of the movement. And then the humiliation of men also comes along with that. It's like saying everybody needs to submit. But of course, the first targets are often the most vulnerable in these situations. Sexual minorities, ethnic minorities, religious minorities, women, and also sometimes children, unfortunately.
And this is one thing I've learned from both your books, and that is, okay, you provide that big context, both in the public school arena with the Good News Club, and then the whole thing about the Christian nationalism in the power worshipers. But one thing that struck me when I was reading through those two books was, you know, you could combine all of what you just said under the rubric of the quote-unquote family. You know, so you get a guy like Tony Perkins or Dr. James Dobson, focus on the family, Family Research Council. But when they say family, what they mean is a heterosexual man and woman having children, godly children and all that. So if you're gay, if you're having an abortion, all those things go against the quote unquote family. And see, it seems to me like that's really their argument. They're saying, hey, if we're going to define what the family is, and if you don't fit into that model, you're going to be excluded. You don't fit in.
You know, it's interesting. I see that as just really marketing, because fundamentally, religious nationalism all over the world has some remarkable similarities. When we're talking about Turkey or Iran or Russia, there are these striking commonalities. You have the demonization of others, the rise of a crony elite, right? Mm-hmm. The kleptocracy. So yes, of course, there's the inevitable patriarchy and misogyny, but there's also restrictions on speech. The restrictions or sometimes persecution of political opposition and reliance on propaganda. So not only, you know, do religious nationalists around the world have a lot in common, but they also often form alliances based on mutual hostility to what they perceive as, quote, godless liberalism. So a lot of this family stuff is the way to get the little people on board. We all care about families, don't we? We all care about our families and our family members. But all of that becomes a sort of pretext for bringing in this sort of deeply authoritarian agenda that carries with it, again, hostility to the freedoms we hold dear, freedom of speech or freedom to engage in politics and in an equal way, freedom to vote, the right to vote, freedom to express your views in public and engage in political opposition if you want to.
Yeah, it's so true, isn't it? Every time you have any form of quote-unquote theocratic government, whatever that might be, Calvin's Geneva or, you know, England after Cromwell, these rights get rolled right back. Any progressive gain gets done away with in the you know, the guise of religious law. And that's what's happening in America, and not just America, like you say, in other countries too. This rise of authoritarianism, this is the thing. Trump's not even bothering to hide, is he, what he's going to do? I'm going to be a dictator. Oh, it's only one day. Ha ha ha, you know, so he's saying, I'm going to weaponize the Justice Department. I'm going to go after my political enemies. you know, and he's just saying it straight up. And now he's been, he's been proven in a court of law that he's a sexual assaulter. He's a fraud business-wise. And yet his base just, you know, they support him all the more.
But I think, you know, before we go, we have to note that a lot of the facts out there really can lead to hopeful or optimistic conclusions. So I'll just give you a couple examples. Look, I'm not an optimist. I'm not a pessimist. I'm an investigator.
You're a realist.
And I lay out the facts. But I do, one of the facts is that most Americans are not okay with this far-right agenda, whether it's the economic side, the family stuff, the efforts to, you know, regulate our freedom with regards to reproductive freedom, freedom to love who, you know, whether you want to love someone of the same sex or opposite sex, whatever, defunding and destroying public education, or anything else. So there are more of us than them. They are a disproportionately mobilized minority. So if we can mobilize as well by getting out the base, persuading those who are on the fence, and yes, even maybe, you know, having conversations and, you know, flipping some people on the other side or drawing them to our side, our democracy really stands a chance. And I think it's important to note that, you know, the religious right is disproportionately mobilized because of this organizational infrastructure. So those of us who are opposed to this movement need to invest in whatever way we can in that organizational infrastructure as well, whether it's working with other people who are seeking to protect the vote or get out the vote, working with if you belong to a church, for instance, or a community group, talk to people, members of your group, and try to, you know, reorient them if you can, or work through more enlightened organizations. And we need messaging and organizing that appeals to all Americans, religious and non-religious alike. So there are so many different avenues for engagement. And frankly, I think everyone has a role to play.
I love that you've got a positive spin on it. I hope you're right, Catherine. I really do. I know you have to go. You got a very tight schedule, but last couple of questions. And how can people find the movie? Because what I've understood is it's only playing in selected theaters. If it's not in their area, do you know, will it be available online at some point? And then also,
Yes, it will stream at some point. And right. I don't have the details of that right now, but it will stream at some point. So
okay.
Looking forward. And thank you so much. It's really such a pleasure to connect with you again.
Yes. Last thing then, how can people find you on social media before I let you go?
Thank you. Well, my Twitter handle is Kath S. Stewart. There are two S's there. That's Kath S. Stewart. And yes, I'm still on Twitter, but yes, I still call it Twitter. So
not X. You're just not going to bow the knee to Musk, are you?
Oh, and I do have another book coming out in February 2025. I do not yet have an Amazon page for it. It's also with Bloomsbury. So please look for it a year from now, February.
Absolutely. Well, let's have you back. We'll promote the book. So thank you so much, Catherine. Absolutely enjoyed talking. Glad your work's getting out there. That's the good news. So take care, and I will speak to you again.
Thank you.